When Adam and I were planning the service, he said, I think I could come up with something relevant. So before I start, I want to say, sit back, settle in. This is the last time I'm going to be standing here, so I've got a lot to say. Layman Bates, the pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, says the reason they really like it when I came to preach was because my average sermon is 12 to 15 minutes, and he said that when he hit 25 was when he felt like he was really getting going. I'm going to get him. So, I'm going to tell you a couple of stories this morning. Not the kind of stories we Unitarian Universalists usually tell one another. Not the kind of stories to which we usually even give much credence when we hear others tell them. To be sure, this isn't true of all of us. Yet, as a generalization, and as we are most often seen by people in the wider world, our elevation of and commitment to the rational leads us to see such decidedly irrational stories as I'm going to be telling to be problematic at best. Historically, at least, Unitarian Universalism has encouraged a healthy skepticism. We've been largely agnostic at heart. The English author W. Somerset Maugham once observed, "A Unitarian very earnestly disbelieves in almost everything that anybody else believes, and they have a very lively, sustaining faith in they don't quite know what." The first story happened a whole bunch of years ago, back when a primary tool for mass communication was the listserv. My kids are here. That was in the before times. A colleague posted on a list asking for help about a conundrum in which she'd found herself caught. A member of the congregation she served had died recently. A short time after the memorial service, the deceased woman's husband came to talk with her. "Don't tell my son any of this," he said. "We've always been extremely rational in our family. We believe that if you can't see, taste, touch, hear, or feel it, it isn't real. We don't go in for any of that spiritual woo-woo. We're scientific rationalists all the way. So if my son knew about this, he'd think I was losing it." This he wanted to talk to my colleague about, and which he wanted to have kept from his son, was that since his wife's death, he'd continued to feel her presence. Literally. He knew that it wasn't a memory or wishful thinking or a projection or a delusion or a psychotic break. He still didn't believe in any kind of spiritual woo-woo, ghosts, life after death, spirits. Yet he also knew that he had been experiencing the undeniable presence of his wife, even though she had died. As you can imagine, this threw him for a loop. But that wasn't the problem my colleague was writing about. She'd been able to talk with him about his experiences, trying to help him make sense out of them. The problem came when the woman's son came to talk with her. He also requested that she not tell his dad about anything that he was about to say because he knew his dad would think he was losing it. But since his mom had died, he'd been experiencing her almost physical presence with him. It didn't make any sense to him. It didn't fit with anything he believed. Yet still, he had rock-solid certainty that these experiences were real nonetheless. So that was her conundrum. It was obvious that these two men needed to talk with each other about their experiences. Yet she felt beholden to respect each of their requests not to tell the other. So what was she supposed to do? Her question was pretty quickly and easily answered. A whole bunch of us agreed that without breaking her promise, she could say to either one or both something along the lines of, "I've been thinking about what we talked about, and I know that you think your son or father would think you're losing it, yet I'd seriously encourage you to talk to them about it. I think you owe it to your relationship with each other and with your wife or mother. I also think you'd be surprised by the response you'd receive." As I said, her question was quickly taken care of. Yet the thread that grew out of it went on for several months, as I remember. And that's because, slowly at first, person after person posted something that began like, "I've hardly ever told anyone about this, but..." And they'd then go on to tell the story of something rather unbelievable, something that didn't align with our profession's much touted rationality, yet which the person knew with every fiber of their being was true. Some confessed that they'd actually never told anybody about this thing. One even noted, "I've never even told my wife about this." Yet on and on the litany went, post after post, day after day, story after story, experiences that didn't make sense, yet which the person who'd experienced it knew in their core were real. We may be inclined to disbelieve this kind of thing, yet I'd remind you of the words Shakespeare had Hamlet say to his friend, "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophies." More recently, it's been observed, the universe is not only more strange than you imagine, it's more strange than you can imagine. I'd always believed that it was the scientist and science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke who said that, but this week I've learned that it actually goes back to a passage in the 1927 essay Possible Worlds by the British Indian physiologist, geneticist, evolutionary biologist, and mathematician J.B.S. Haldane, who wrote, "Now my own suspicion is that the universe is not only queerer than we suppose, but queerer than we can suppose. I have read and heard many attempts at a systematic account of it, from materialism and theosophy to the Christian system or that of Kant, and I have always felt that they were much too simple. I suspect that there are more things in heaven and earth that are dreamed of or can be dreamed of in any philosophy." The title of this sermon, It's Almost Enough, comes from one of my own experiences, one of my own stories. In 2001, I was enrolled in the spiritual guidance program of the Shalem Institute for Spiritual Formation, which is the same program that Wendy Steeves, our office assistant, recently completed. The program is largely done at a distance, but all of the participants came together for a 9-day retreat once in each of the 2 years. There was a lot of instruction, a lot of prayer, a lot of silence, a lot of time for contemplation, and a whole lot of spiritual woo-woo. That irrational stuff that is eschewed by so many UUs. On one of the first days of the retreat, we were given a prayer exercise. Now, it's Shalem's perspective that prayer isn't something we do. Rather, God is always praying in us. So what we do in that thing we call prayer is to quiet ourselves enough to hear God's prayer in us, for us. I'll note that Shalem is decidedly ecumenical in orientation, even with their deep openness to other faith traditions and spiritual perspectives. Still, a theistic perspective is core to their understanding of life, the universe, and everything. So the concept of God is foundational to them, albeit not with its most common understanding. Anyway, in the experience, we were asked to try to find an inner place of peace, a mood of meditation, something you may have heard about, and to allow the thought or feeling of a person we knew well to rise up in our consciousness. In other words, to listen for who God might be praying for in and through us. When we felt that we knew the who, we were then to try again to quiet ourselves and listen for the what. To listen for what God's prayer might be for that person. After a little while, we were then invited to do the same thing for someone we didn't know all that well, and then finally for someone with whom we were having some kind of difficulties. When I was focusing on someone we didn't know that well, one of the other participants kept coming up. I saw her in my mind's eye. She was standing there with Jesus. He knelt in front of her and she put her hands on his head. Then she sunk to her knees and the two embraced, crying. Now, I honestly don't think I had spoken more than a couple of words to this woman by this point in the retreat, so you can imagine that it was with a little trepidation that I went up to her during one of the breaks to tell her about this vision I had just had and ask if it meant anything to her. She looked really shocked. She said that some years ago she'd had a hands-on healing ministry, but had been scared by something and had stopped. We were told to come to the retreat with a question to ponder, and hers was whether or not she should begin this ministry again. She felt that the vision I'd had during prayer was at least a pointer for her to that answer. A few days later, someone came up to me and said that in her prayer that morning, I kept coming to mind along with the hymn, "Here I Am, Lord." The hymn draws on a story from the Hebrew scriptures in which the character of God keeps calling out to a young boy named Samuel by name. And each time Samuel answers, "Here I am, Lord." This was also the hymn we sang a lot at the Methodist church camp the year I first felt my call to ordained ministry. And the question I had brought to that retreat was whether I should stay in the ordained ministry. This person's prayer, though she could have had no way of knowing it, was for me a pointer towards my answer. And here I am, 18 years later. God bless you. Stuff like that happened a lot that week. Prayers being answered, needed message given and received. We even had a couple of hands-on healings, physical healings. A whole lot of spiritual woo-woo. Now, at the time, I considered myself a Zen, Taoist, neo-pagan, historically Christian, currently atheistic, Unitarian Universalist. So all of this didn't fit with any of my philosophies. The cohort with whom I went through the program consisted of Catholic nuns and priests, pastors from various Protestant traditions, lay people, a staunchly rational atheist, humanist, psychiatrist, and a Zen Taoist neo-pagan, historically Christian, currently atheistic, Unitarian Universalist. Early on, I became good friends with two of the other participants, a Baptist clergyman and a Presbyterian laywoman, and I am glad to say we are still friends after all these years. And I say that because I know they're going to read this sermon. Hi, guys. I don't remember any longer which one of us coined the phrase, but whoever said it, it stuck. Whenever we would hear one of these stories about something queerer than you can imagine, we'd reply, "You know, it's almost enough." Actually, the full phrase was, "You know, it's almost enough to make you believe in God." Almost enough. Physical healings, seeing, hearing answers to questions we didn't know were being asked by people we'd never met. Miracles, for want of a better word, both big and small, and we'd say somewhat ironically that these were almost enough to make one believe in God. Now I know that God is one of those words many you use don't want to hear in their sanctuaries during Sunday services. It's meaningless, it's harmful. The 14 times we uttered it during the opening hymn and the 8 or so times that Adam said it were more than enough for some people for the next several years. The Sunday after Virginia legalized same-sex marriage, I put on the altar 2 placards that had been created for a protest that were no longer needed. One said, "All love is equal." The other said, "God is love." So strong is the allergy to traditional God language among some of us that I know at least one member of this congregation came in that morning, saw the sign on the altar with the word God on it, and then turned around and left in disgust. I do understand that what has been and still is so often referred to by that word, God, is utterly meaningless and has been used to inflict great harm. I understand that. Yet I also know the philosophical definition of the word. God is that than which no greater can be conceived. This means that whatever God is, it's the greatest, the best, the most life-affirming, the most awesome, the most expansive. It's that for which no greater attribute can be conceived. The way the word God has been and is still so often being used is incredibly limited and limiting. The way the word God is all too often misunderstood simply can't be what that word is pointing to, because it's so easy to imagine something greater. And this means that those understandings of God simply can't be what God is. The word God, when properly understood, is so unlimited that no less an authority than St. Augustine said, "If you can understand it, if you can grasp it, it's not God." Si comprehendis, non est Deus. I didn't go to school for nothing. It cost me thousands of dollars. When I did my chaplaincy training all those years ago, my supervisor told us what she would say when a patient told her that they didn't need a chaplain's visit because they don't believe in God. She'd say, "Tell me about this God you don't believe in. I probably don't believe in that God either." That God isn't what God is. And if that God isn't God, then God might have meaning after all, even for us skeptical, agnostic, rational UUs who disbelieve anything, almost anything that anybody else believes, and who have a very lively, sustaining faith in we don't quite know what. In his address to the graduating class of Harvard Divinity School in 1838, Ralph Waldo Emerson asked those freshly minted ministers, "In how many churches, by how many prophets, tell me, are people made sensible that they are an infinite soul, that the heavens are passing into their mind, that they are drinking forever the soul of God? Not given dogma or stern warnings, but told that they are themselves intimately a part of what God is, that they are inseparably part of something truly larger than themselves." The answer is, not in too many Unitarian Universalist churches today, I'm afraid. In his essay, Nature, St. Ralph described an experience he had had in which he was standing on the bare ground, my head bathed by the blithe air and uplifted into infinite space. All mean egotism vanishes. I become a transparent eyeball. I love that phrase. I am nothing. I see all. The currents of the universal being circulate through me. I am part and parcel of God. In how many churches, by how many prophets, are we being told that we are part or parcel of God? I believe it was the first sermon I preached during candidating week for the first congregation I served, which some encouraged me not to give. It was called "A Feather on the Breath of God," a phrase used by the Catholic saint Hildegard of Bingen to describe herself. "Don't talk about God right out of the gate," some people advised me. "It doesn't go over well." Yet here I stand 25 years later. Since I started out talking explicitly about God, it seems right to talk explicitly about God in this last sermon too. Truth be told, I've done so in many, many sermons over the years since, maybe even in most of them, honestly. I don't always use that word. You may not even have noticed, but I did. And that's because when we talk about God, we're really talking about the ultimate reality in which, through which, and by which we live. What a child once called the really real. The really real, in which, as the Apostle Paul told us, we live and move and have our being. When we talk about God, we're talking about that which surrounds us, penetrates us, and binds the galaxy together, to quote the esteemed theologian Obi-Wan Kenobi. We're talking about, really, the only thing that's really worth talking about. Because that towards which the word God points is not some angry and judgmental anthropomorphic cosmic cop on the lookout for any infraction. No. When we talk about God, we're talking about justice. We're talking about truth. We're talking about life. We're talking about love. What else should we be talking about? Look around you. Really open your eyes and look around you. Look at your own life. What do you see when you do? A child's open smile. The warm touch of the person you love and who loves you most in all the world. Leaves rustling on the trees when a stultifyingly hot day shifts with an incoming storm. The pastel pinks and blues of sunrise, the vibrant crimson and azure of sunsets. The realization that you found an answer for which you were seeking. The courage to act on it. Comfort in times of your own brokenness. Strength when others need it from you. Beauty, even in the presence of brutality. The healing of body, mind, and spirit, even when there is no cure. People who challenge our complacency, people who point the way when we feel lost, people, plain and simple, other people. Animals, plants, rivers, rocks, stars, moments of clarity about what really matters. Every breath we take, every move we make. I'm so glad you got that one. Will they or won't they? I don't know. Go for it. What are they going to do? Adam said he was hoping that I was going to preach the longest sermon that had ever been preached here. And I'm working on it. What do you see? What do you hear? The sound of music. The sound of silence. The sound of life lived well. Of life lived poorly. Of life lived the best we know how. The best we can. The sound of life lived in love. And love lived in our lives. All of that is real. Really real. All of it shows us, grounds us in the truth that, as I've been saying for years, we are one human family on one fragile planet in one miraculous universe bound by love. All of it, revealing the truth that we are not alone. The truth that in the end, justice will prevail. All of it reminds us of the twin truths that life is stronger than death and that love is stronger than anything. All of it, God. Look around you. Really look around you, my friends, and really see what it is that you are looking at. And you know what? It'll be almost enough. Let's take a moment of silence.